Can't sleep? Don't want to sleep? Afraid to sleep? Are the windows closed? Are your doors locked? Did you check your closet? And under your bed? Maybe you should keep a light on in the hallway, just in case. Now settle in. Make yourself comfortable. Lay back, close your eyes, and let me tell you a story. Have you ever seen a man on a busy street corner, or perhaps on the side of a highway, maybe in the crowd at a stadium, holding up a sign saying, "The end is nigh"? You might assume he's crazy, but what if he's not? What if the end of days is just around the corner? Waiting for that final sign, something innocuous, the last piece of a hidden puzzle dropping into place. Perhaps it's as simple as an unlikely baseball team winning the World Series. In the Garden of End Times by Jody J. Sperling. Jesus finished the beetle picking early and went to a village in rural Kent for a beer. What she really looked forward to was the day of restoration, when she could drink wine again. But 2,000 years ago, incarnate in the masculine, Jesus had been the sort to dole out hasty vows, which is why he said, "For I say unto you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God shall come." And promises are promises. The normal retinue of tagalongs were in attendance, and sitting on a high stool, Jesus was trying to ignore a rabbi's doctrinal barrage of questions on account of the television, tuned to ESPN. The ticker at the bottom of the screen showed the Chicago Cubs had lost again. Anywhere her father plants his gardens, from the South Bronx to Macassar, Jesus hunts for Cubs scores, because this is all her father has told her regarding his timeline for the restoration. "You will know the time is near when the Cubs win the World Series 3 times. Which, think about it, for nearly 1900 years, that reference meant less than nothing. And so for the past 120, give or take, the very existence of baseball has been a good indicator of final things astir. What a tease, then, is the father. Chicago put 2 series in the bag, back to back, in the early part of the 20th century. And Jesus was picking out fashionable summer robes for her return to Jerusalem. But hold the rod and staff. The Cubbies hadn't gone all the way since 1908, which, yes, to Jesus, is the blink of an eye. But even blinking is longer than not blinking. Contemplating the Cubs' recent loss, Jesus ordered a honey wheat lager, and while waiting for her drink, let her hair down, shaking the thick mop of brown curls. A few stools down, a young woman, about the age of Jesus' body, looked on. The woman said, "Excuse me, is this rabbi bothering you?" It's not the rabbi per se, nor though is it the work Jesus resents. Not the weather, not even the ferociously ticklish business of incarnation, that taking on of skin and bones from the sexless, timeless paradise that is home. It's the assumptions. How all the rabbis and priests, and pastors and clerics, and cardinals and chazans, and elders and deacons and zaddiks, who gather at her father's gardens, argue their case. Seems, if one's to listen to all that those religious folks go on, most anybody could do a better job of things than Jesus and her pops, and the fickle Holy Spirit. "Too hard to explain any of that," Jesus said. "Yes," and cast a glare at the rabbi. "But I don't need any help, if that's what you're asking." "Hey, pal," the woman said to the rabbi. Leave the lady alone.
I said I didn't need any help,
Jesus said. She fixed her gaze on the row of liquor bottles beneath the mirror that ran the length of the bar.
I'm man enough to handle my own problems.
What did you say?
I'm man enough to handle my own problems.
The woman looked Jesus up and down, lingering on her bust, and laughed.
Wonders never cease.
She straightened the heavy framed glasses on her face and said,
There's nothing wrong with being a strong woman.
Jesus said,
There are no strong women, only women and men.
Jesus effing Christ.
That's me, the Alpha and the Omega. Not so much the middle part, though.
Heavy frames narrowed her eyes and tilted her head.
Just Jesus Christ. I don't have a middle name, and if I did, it certainly wouldn't be effing.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You're clearly insane. It's not worth trying to disabuse you of your sexism,
Heavy Frame said.
It's sad that we live in a world where even women buy into the idea that only men can be strong.
Heavy Frames was turning to recapture her bar stool when Jesus said,
Strength is a masculine quality. Why is that a problem? I'm pretending I didn't hear that,
Heavy Frame said. She buried mouth and nose in her wine glass and drained a long draft down her throat. Her hair, fixed in place with incredible amounts of gel, spoke more of the times and of her sexual orientation. Lesbians in Rome had worn flowers in their hair. Gays grew chest-length beards and blackened their leg and arm hair with charcoal. Jesus said,
Then you're making peace, which is a feminine quality.
Heavy Frame swung around, her face red-stained with rage.
I don't know where you come from or who taught you such bullshit, but I'll tell you that where I'm from, there are plenty of strong women who stand for their beliefs, and plenty of men who run from a fight, which I think is what you mean when you say making peace.
You have said so,
Jesus said.
Oh, piss off,
Heavy Frame said, and it was about time to be heading off.
Jesus smiled, dropped a gold coin on the bar, drank off her beer, and told the rabbi to wait up. It was good living in a woman's body. Jesus could slip into the restroom, where the rabbi would not follow, lock a stall door, and ascend to paradise.
They're called Japanese beetles, and Jesus lately spends the growing season plucking the little bastards from her father's rose gardens. In the dusk of a punishing summer afternoon, when storm clouds zip the heat in and lightning peals across the horizon, when it could be AD 33 for all the rage the heavens promised to unleash, and when Jesus is wearing light-duty cotton gloves, pinching oil-slicked, green-glowing, redly-reflective, armor-winged insect bodies from the finely chewed leaves of scented rose plants, when it's like that, all Jesus can think about is doing the whole robes dipped in blood, rider on a white horse, sharpened sword, come to judge the living and the dead thing. It started back in the year 2000, when Japanese beetles were still a problem only the Japanese dealt with. Jesus' father had planted his gardens in Kobe. Near the end of the blooming season, Jesus was instructed to harvest as many plants as she could manage and arrange their shipment to Israel. There would be a great feast in Jerusalem that year, and the father wanted his rose gardens to be the main attraction. Jesus had never transplanted, let alone transported, grown rose plants, and she knew something was afoot, something more than the simple movement of flowers for a feast. She asked, if possible, that that cup be taken from her, but as in prior times, the father was mute in response to the request. Second only to blood, the red damask rose pleased the father most. Careful to pluck every beetle from the plant's leaves, Jesus potted 20 dozen roses, called the Kobe Shipping Company, and arranged for delivery. The potted soil had been treated for larvae, but somehow, somewhere, one of the rose plants must have escaped notice. The following year, there were reports of a species of beetle attacking beans and roses and practically any leafing plant all throughout the Middle East. Yasser Arafat accused the Israeli military of attempting a new biological warfare, but the accusations were muffled when it became clear that beetles harassed every land, government, and people, regardless of national affiliation and religious persuasion. Jesus' father sent her to Dubai to tend roses that year. Even in Dubai, Catholic priests and Jewish Zadoks found her. Their greatest point of contention that summer regarded Jesus wearing a hijab. Jesus replied, "Would you have me crucified again?"
"Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar," the priest said,
but the rabbis were not satisfied. There was no beer at all to be enjoyed there, and fresh yogurt with figs only appeals for so long. One day, around dusk, when the roses were in full bloom, and the Japanese beetles had been hand-plucked from every leaf on the rose bushes, Jesus suggested to the priest, an elderly man, and the only one among the religious stalkers who seemed to have warmed slightly to Jesus, that they brew mead in the cellar on the property where her father's roses grew. The priest had not brewed strong drink since he left the Trappist monastery, seeking a commission to bring relief to God's workers in the Middle East. They waited for final dusk and slipped out of the compound. In a field not far out of town, where a grove of oaks and cedars had been planted, and where the government had allotted millions of gallons of water to be poured, Jesus and the priest found a wild beehive. Jesus prayed over a fallen branch nearby, and the spirit kissed its brittle bark with tongues of flame. Jesus tossed green leaves and milkweed on the fire, and the resulting smoke she used to tame the hive. The priest hiked his habit and scaled the tree after Jesus said, "You have a penis. Being a man comes more naturally to you. Be brave." Later, the priest would express surprise at what Jesus had said, and Jesus would say, "I can be a man if necessary, but it is hard work." The priest would not be comforted or enlightened by Jesus' assessment. All told, they harvested a gallon of fresh honey, leaving that much and more for the bees to nourish their hive. The bees in the Middle East were the most generous bees in all the world. Perhaps they knew they were closer to God's holiness than other creatures, and this was a geographical knowledge as well. Acquiring distilled water happened to be more difficult than harvesting honey. It was finally by sleight that Jesus convinced a rabbi to go to market and obtain the needed water. "How can we perform our ablutions to the code of if we have fouled water?" The rabbi was wary of Jesus' request for 10 gallons, but eventually conceded. He returned with the plastic jugs and only one gold coin remaining from the 20 Jesus had sent him to town with. "Distillate is more valuable than explosives in these parts," the rabbi said. At midnight that same night, Jesus and the priest mixed the honey with water and live yeast. Before Jesus could enjoy the fruit of her labor, the Father called her home, and the next day, she ascended after watering the rose garden one final time. To this day, there is likely yet a generous supply of deeply fermented mead hidden in the cellar of the abandoned compound, where the wild roses grow, and where the Japanese beetles feast freely each year. In the summer of the 16th year of the 21st century, the father planted his garden in Omaha, Nebraska. Jesus was tempted to question the location, what with the prairie expanse and the negligible population. Jesus had spent her share of summers in humid climates, enough to know she favored desert climes. The father said, "Were you not born in Nazareth?" It was true. Somewhere in the center of the Godhead, there was favor shown to the insignificant places. Jesus was somewhat familiar with post-postmodern Western culture, having spent the previous summer in the English countryside, where she had met heavy frames and drank beer with a rabbi, a priest, and a zaddik. But Omaha, from all the news Jesus had read, was not only the opposite of a destination getaway, but a vestige, an outlier, of the American Bible Belt community. Jesus materialized in a field of corn. Why was she always dressed in white robes? It would have been no trouble for the father to spend 5 minutes online researching current fashions, but always robes. At least the cornfield appeared to be in the middle of the city. Jesus came out of the stalks onto a straight road. She followed it to an intersection, 132nd and Dodge, and spotted a glowing sign that read, Hy-Vee. She patted her robes and found the standard 33 gold coins, one for every year she had suffered as a man during her first appearance. Everywhere about her, cars seemed rushed. Jesus nearly was hit by a truck as she crossed the off-ramp at Dodge towards the Hy-Vee. In the parking lot of the store, a young driver piloting a small red car blared his horn at Jesus. Near the entrance, two young girls pointed and laughed at that freak in the robes. Father, Jesus prayed silently, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Hy-Vee was a grocery store. Jesus asked a boy in a white-collared shirt and tan khaki pants where she might find a selection of clothing for sale. The boy scoffed. He didn't know if there was anywhere in town that carried robes. He also seemed to pity Jesus.
No, you misunderstand me. I'm looking for, what was the word? Normal clothes. The type of thing a woman my age would wear.
The boy thought for a moment.
There's a Target down on Maple. Where?
The boy's face scrunched. He knew he was experiencing something unique, but he couldn't decide if it was the kind of unique thing he should respect or scorn.
Keep west on 132nd, he said. Walking, Jesus found it difficult to breathe. The air, so full of moisture, caused her to wrestle for every lungsful. She arrived at Target panting and painted with sweat. The wool of her robes beneath her arms and around her thighs was soaked through. She aimed directly for the woman's clothing and snapped up two camisoles, three 36C cream-colored brassieres, horrible contraptions that most definitely caused cancer, but which she could not get away without wearing in 21st century America. Two button-down plaid shirts, two pairs of 95% cotton Mossimo jean shorts, and a packet of cotton Hanes underwear. The cost of goods and gold was difficult to estimate, but Jesus had it going for her that she could always manage to find an ailing cashier, some middle-aged woman who suffered from especially painful menopause or an acute case of arthritis. And to that woman, Jesus could offer the gold coin and healing in exchange for the woman to use her own credit card to complete the needed purchase. Such was the case at Target. And Mary Druthers, 51, mother of James and Devin, would return to her husband with a coin valued at $800, and free of the wave of hormones that caused her to nightly scream at her husband Lachey for the most inane of circumstances. Jesus not only invested in that woman's financial well-being, but she rescued an ailing marriage with her healer's touch. Discarding her robes in the bathroom wastebasket, Jesus dressed in her new clothes. That which she bought for later, she bundled inside the second button-up, tying it off at the sleeves. The next matter of business was to find her father's rose garden. Over the past decade, the father had taken increasing pleasure in making the initial hunt more challenging. Jesus had spent the better part of her first week turning over every nook and cranny in the south of Kent, looking for her plot of damasks. Omaha was a smaller community, but more spread out, and the thought of hunting in the humid, high sun heat was almost more than she could bear. She walked east along Maple, a bit aimless, and feeling angry. Crows lit on the shoulder of the road some distance ahead, pecking the remains of an animal that had failed to ford the street. Jesus stopped short of the dead animal. Seeing it was a medium-sized tabby cat, Jesus felt compassion. She inclined her face to heaven and prayed. At first, the crows seemed undisturbed by Jesus' behavior and what was happening to their lunch. But when the cat mewed, revived by the spirit, the crows hopped back a smidge. And the cat rolled to its feet and sprung at the nearest crow, tearing its throat out. The bird died without protest. The cat nuzzled its kill to the feet of Jesus, and Jesus stooped to thank the cat. "Go ahead, eat it. You must be famished. Death is a very tiring business, and life so much more." The cat butted its head against Jesus' soft ankles, and turning, set about picking the meat from its kill. Jesus scanned the horizon. At the intersection of 120th and Maple, there was a man, elderly, wearing filthy clothing. He held a sign. "Repent, the end is near." Jesus walked through the heavy wet air, leaving the cat to its meal. He hoped the cat had learned its lesson and would turn back from the road when it was well nourished. Nearing the filthy man, Jesus called out, "You wouldn't happen to know of any new rose gardens in the area?" The filthy man lowered his sign slightly. His jaw hung slack. This was always the way with the religious. They sensed Jesus before they knew her. But even though they came to know her, she never withheld her identity. They never embraced her. This filthy man was especially dumbfounded. "You're the Son of God." It was Jesus' turn to marvel.
"You have said so."
"Never thought you'd be so pretty."
The Son of Man was not one to behold.
"Well, tastes change, I suppose."
"Perhaps," Jesus said.
She was at least considering the possibility that to one who recognizes God and man, beauty is of limited importance.
"Can you believe these folks?" the filthy man said. "Every one of them drives past here. And not a one of them so much as look at me. They all seem to think I got disease in my bones."
Jesus saw that, in fact, the man did have disease, though not in his bones, but in his mind.
He suffered from a lack of monoamine, serotonin synthesis, resulting condition, severe anhedonia.
Likely the man left his street side post each day to return home, wherever home was, and upon reaching that place, succumbed to a crushing weight of depression near unto suicide.
"May I lay hands on you?" Jesus asked.
"Be my guest," the filthy man said. "Ain't been touched by no hands in longer than I can remember."
Jesus did, and she drew the sick from him. The filthy man's eyes brightened, and with the light there, he seemed not half so foul.
"A mighty kindness," the man said.
Jesus said,
"Now, about those rose gardens."
The man folded his sign. It felt weightless to him. Might be every driver down that stretch of road was aimed right at hell, and it couldn't seem to matter suddenly.
"Don't seem to remember any news of new rose gardens." "Over there," he pointed crosswise through the intersection, "there's the best garden shop in all Omaha. They'd likely to know about new gardens, I expect."
Jesus followed the man's outstretched arm.
"Thank you," she said.
The man nodded.
Turning to walk away, Jesus paused. She looked back. "What about the Cubs? The Chicago Cubs?"
"Good gosh almighty," the man said. "They nearly won the whole cheese last year. Come right up to the Mets and crashed. This year they're supposed to be twice as good. I expect it might be high time."
Jesus waved and thanked the man. The Cubs, who had been in third place in their division when she returned to her father from Kent the year before, had almost won it. And they were even better this season. As she walked to the garden store, she could almost taste the wine on her lips.
Thank you for listening to In the Garden of End Times by Jody J. Sperling.
This story was originally published in Moth Magazine. If you're a fan of booze-fueled, hard-boiled detective stories with a splash of magic, check out his Luke in Time mystery series and his other books, available at jodyjsperling.com. And check out his podcast, Becoming a Household Name, on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to follow him on Substack at jodyjsperling.substack.com. Thanks again, and all the very best.